Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Fred. I've asked Zach to come up and tell us a joke.
All right. A moderate drinker finds a fly in his drink and asks the bartender to pour him a fresh one. A heavy drinker finds a fly in his drink, pulls it out by the wings, and just keeps drinking. An alcoholic finds a fly in his drink, and he holds it up and says, "All right, spit it out."
Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation. So please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices that make noise or will distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. With that, is everybody ready? If so, let's start the meditation. Everybody can join me in the fog light prayer. If you don't know it, it's up on the stage. God, like a fog light, so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. From there is a solution from the big book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Chad to read the recovered statement, to read spiritual experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know what one is.
Chad, alcoholic. Spiritual experience. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, shows that personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unexpected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is a sense of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer, Alcoholics Anonymous, page 567-568.
Thank you, Chad. Please refrain from disturbing others or talking or constantly getting back up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so set your phones to airplane or meeting mode or just turn them off. I'm going to keep it short and simple. Joe has led us with, I think we're on the sixth step tonight. You know, it's a man of God. He walks the walk, and when he talks, every time he does, I get something new out of it. So with that, here's Joe.
Thanks, Fred. So, hi everybody. I'm an alcoholic and a member of the Wednesday Night Big Book Study Group. My name's Joe. Good to see you all here tonight, those that brave the rain and the weather to get here. Anybody at the Big Book Seminar this past weekend from here? Yeah? Great. That's why we didn't have a meeting here last week. And it was fabulous. I called Mike at the beginning of last week. They were doing a tribute to my former sponsor. Mike knows him very well, John Williams, who passed this last year. And he was part of that seminar for many, many years. Matter of fact, since its inception. And so that was very special, and it was an honor to be there. So having said that, I believe this is my sixth week somewhere there, but I'm not on the sixth step. Last time we were together, we spoke about the four step, right? We spoke about this investigation, this inventory that we're going to do in order to find out several things. Why we have become who we've become, what drives us, what motivates us, what dominates our thinking. You know, it's kind of like the chase of everything that we're after in life. Everything that we think is going to be important to us. Everything that we think is going to satisfy us. Everything that we think is going to fulfill us. You know, all those things. All those things that go on in our mind, right? That are constantly conversing with, you know, this little committee that we have inside our brain, inside our mind. Dictating what we think. Dictating how we feel. Dictating what we do. And the results that we get in life, right? And all of us, by the time we get here, we are pretty devastated with the results that we've been getting in our life. And you have to know this. This is critical to everything. That our lives, up to the point of getting here, and every consequence and part of the past that we have, this chapter that we have that's called our life up to the point of getting here, and doing this inventory, actually, because we're still doing it after we get here. We may just stop drinking and drugging, but we still continue to think the same way and get the same feelings and emotions and take the same actions, get the same results, right? Maybe not to the degree that we were getting them, but they're still running us. And everything that we bring in here with us, that thing called the past, right, is nothing more than a snapshot of our thinking. Everything's born in thought. Everything. We think, the thought creates a feeling or an emotion, whatever we're thinking about. The thought or emotion convicts us to act, right? And we get a result. So we think, we feel, we act, we get a result. It's a synchronicity thing in our mind. It's just the way it is, right? So we're doing this investigation at this juncture. We talked about the resentment factor a couple weeks ago. We've come to some conclusions. Hopefully you've come to the conclusion that you're truly an alcoholic, can't manage your own life or thinking, right? But anytime we refer to life in the big book, we're referring to our thinking. It's one and the same, right? And know exactly what that means. With all the information that we've read and studied and looked at and talked about, in a nutshell, it's that when I put this stuff in, whatever it is, I can't stop or control it. Something happens in my body, doesn't happen into a normal drinker or a normal drugger, that makes it virtually impossible for me to stop. I must be stopped, right? Dr. Silkworth called it an allergy, this abnormal reaction to a food, a beverage, or a substance, right? But we've all stopped many times, so that's obviously not the crux of the problem. The crux of the problem is stay and stop, right? So we have this obsession of the mind, this ability to con ourselves or lie to ourselves, where we're in such need of escape and relief and numbing out, you know, because of what's going on the inside, that we concoct a lie, it'll be different and nobody will know. And our mind starts developing this lie that we buy, we put it in, we can't stop. So if you can't stop when you start, and you can't stay stopped, you've got this thing. It's a death sentence. And only one, two things are going to happen after that. Once you're convinced of that and concede that to your innermost self, if it's a truth for you, right? One or two things are going to happen. Either you're going to embark on a journey to come to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sane thinking when it comes to drinking, or you're going to die of active alcoholism or drug addiction, period. There's no door number three, right? And we see people dying left and right all the time. Right? So knowing that piece to the puzzle and absolutely being convinced that no human power on earth has been able to relieve us of our alcoholism or keep us stopped, because we've always believed the lie, we've got to make a decision. And we made that decision. We decided that based on the evidence of our life and the pain and torture that we've been going through and putting everybody else through, the thing they say is the annihilation of all things worthwhile in life, right? We make a decision to seek this power. And at this juncture, we're told, well, listen, you don't have to, you're not going to seek it the way you always thought you had to seek it. You're not going to recall the past and go through that and see if you can double down to acquire this thing this relationship with this power that's going to be sufficient to overcome the mania to alcoholism and drug addiction, this obsession in your mind that convinces you only of the things it did for you rather than what it did to you, right? And we're going to lay out the ingredients. We're going to lay out this prescription based on that decision for you to follow. There are a set of instructions. There are a set of directions. They're not suggestions, right? These are directions that if you follow them, you will get the prize of a spiritual awakening. What that means is this profound alteration in our reaction to life. We've reacted to life one way, numbing it out. Killing the pain. Relief. You know, we carry around all this stuff on the inside. The resentments, the regret, the remorse, the shame, the guilt. All that stuff that's still within us, that we harbor within us, pretending to everybody else that it's not there, even when we come into AA. I'm sure there's people sitting in here right now that can't even imagine talking about how they're dying inside letting somebody know that they're dying inside and they're weak and they're vulnerable and they don't know what to do. It must be guarded. I have to pretend that it's not there. So you'll think that I'm okay. And it's a lie. It's a lie, right? So they say that we're going to, by making this decision, that we're going to seek this power. And the way that we do it, the first thing that we do is we do this inventory. We do this catalog, this inventory of our of the manifestations of our illness, right? So if we're full of all those things, the fear, the bitterness, the regret, our consciousness is consumed and devoured by it, right? The fear of the future, the fear of the past. What am I going to do? How's it going to, you know, what about my family? What about my children? What about all those things that devour us when we get here, right? They say this. They say it in We Agnostics before we get to chapter 5. They kind of give a little hint about why we have to do this inventory. It says, actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. You see, God is in our DNA. We're born with it. But because we're men and women in the world and men and women of the world most of our lives, we're really entrenched in the world, right? It says it may be obscured, this connection, this channel, this ability to source his power, this ability to relate and have relationship with this God, with our creator, right? They say it may be obscured by calamity, chaos, conflict, by pomp, by worship of other things. And they say it chokes us off from the sunlight of the Spirit, meaning that connection with God, this power, right? This ability to relate and have relationship with our Creator, where we can actually draw on that power and where that obsession is removed through this process. Where we're hoping to develop this relationship such that when we face adversity, when we face calamity, when we face conflict in our lives, in our relationships, that we don't immediately think to numb out or get relief from the very thing that we used to. What we do is we source him. So in other words, it's kind of like this transformation, this profound alteration in our reaction to life, chaos, conflict, adversity, by the comfort and ease that comes from him with certainty at all times, rather than from the booze and the drugs. You see, if we don't have that, we're always going to chase the other. Always. Why do I know that? Evidence. All we got to do is look at our life. Look at our history. Right? So the thing that's drawing us and calling us to relief are the things that we harbor when we get here. And they say resentment is the number one offender. This ability to refeel in our minds, right? I'm not worried about normal people, non-addicted people. I'm not worried about that. I'm talking about us, right? I'm talking about the crippling nature of a resentment that we have that leads us right back to jumping off the cliff or caving into our relief factor, right? They say this thing is this ability to refeel refeel offenses, refeel threats, refeel things that I harbor on the inside, and it destroys my relationships, right? To refeel, resentir, it's a Latin word. Re means again, sentire means to feel. So I'm walking around feeling all the resentments and all the things that people did to me, where I become truly, in my mind, a complete victim. It's never my fault. When I was out there, it was never my fault. It was always your fault. It was always circumstantial why my life was so screwed up, especially towards the end. I couldn't see the truth. The truth was, it was all created by me because of the way I drank and the way I filtered life. Right? But the truth I lived by was, it was your fault. So I got to get down to causes and conditions of these resentments, and they have a perfect format for that. They have, you know, we talked about how we do this last couple of weeks ago. We started on resentments, and we have this template guide that they give us in this book. And you know, it's simply an inventory. I'm sure a lot of people take an inventory so that we can get, you know, we can get a clear picture of what we have in stock, right? If it's a commercial inventory, what we have in stock, what's working, what's not, what's broken, what's not, what's selling, what's not, so I can make some money, so I can be productive with my business. It's all about values, right? Well, they're saying I do that with my life. The things that are objectionable, the liabilities of my character, my personality, right? The defectual behavior, the things that are motivating me to hurt other people, to be satisfied through you for whatever it is, my personal esteem, my emotional esteem, my self-worth, my money, my finances, my ambitions, my relationships, my sexual relationships, right? I'm trying to secure satisfaction, making decisions based on my own satisfaction through you that later place me in a position to be hurt. Because no matter what I get from you, it's never enough. Never enough, right? So I get this down on paper. I make the list of who hurt me. I make the list of what they did to threaten me. Was it my personal security? Was it my personal relationship with them? Was it my self-esteem, my self-worth, my emotional security? Was it my financial security, my sexual security? Or my ambitions, what I hope to achieve in the future? What did you do to affect one of those things that got me really angry, right? But then on the second half of this thing, beyond what it affected with my instincts of character, by the way, they say these instincts that God gave every human being on the face of the planet turn into emotional deformities. They're absolutely necessary for every human being to survive on earth. But we take them far beyond their intended purpose. And we're never satisfied, right? So we try to, and you don't go try to get those things fulfilled out of a wall. You do it with other people. The victims are the other people in our life, right? And they sense that. They sense what we're doing. They know we're gaming. And they retaliate. They say, I'm not going to do that anymore. I don't want nothing to do with you anymore. And it's like, boom, the relationship is dead. And we blame them for ending it. Right? So this happens virtually to all our relationships. All of them. We're so broken when we get here, we have no idea the collateral damage that we've created. Right? So these other two columns are all about, you know, turning back to the list because it held the keys to the future. We were prepared to look at this thing from an entirely different angle. Instead of what they did to me, I'm going to begin to look at what I did to them. How I set this whole thing up and what were the defects of character. Was I simply being inconsiderate in that relationship? Selfish, dishonest in that relationship? Full of fear in that relationship? Was I worried about what I was going to get out of it or what I was going to lose from it? Was I greedy, lustful, prideful? Envious, slothful, gluttonous. I got it all down. And for the first time in my life, I saw who you got from this selfish, self-centered idiot when I showed up on the scene. I was gaming everybody. I did nothing without motive, ever. I was always looking for a payoff and a reward. Always. And when I didn't get it, I tossed you away like a piece of garbage. Right? So we got that all down on paper, and now I got to address this thing called fear. These things that I'm afraid of, that I'm terrified of. And they say we suffer from 100 forms of fear. 100 forms of fear. My life is shot through and riddled with it. You can classify it into two categories. One category would be that which we're, you know, the one fear is that we're not going to get something that we want out of the relationship. Or out of life, right? Or that we're going to lose something that we've already got. Somebody's going to take something, or somebody's going to steal something, or I'm not going to get what I want from you. Or it, or whatever. It could simply be to acknowledge me like I'm somebody. I may be playing a game of making you think you're the greatest person on earth when my sole motive is for you to think that about me. What if you discover the truth about me? What if you see the masquerade I'm really working and gaming you for? What if you really see that I'm selfish and self-centered and I don't care a bit about you, but I'm working you for something that I want? What about the neediness of emotional drag on other people? Because we're such victims sometimes. Takers. We become takers in this deal. You know what I'm saying? And if we're giving with motive. What about the masquerade? What about you know, pretending to be all popular or gravitating towards a certain group of people because they're getting all the attention so I can get it too vicariously? Who am I? I don't know. By the time I got here, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I stood for. I gave you the power that I should have been giving God my entire life. If you would just let me, if you would just acknowledge me as a somebody, I might feel like a somebody. Unfortunately, that payoff never happened. Even if you acknowledged me for that. Because I knew you were acknowledging a fraud. My act may convince some of you that I'm well-traveled and well-successful and all that. Great father, great brother, great son, great family, blah, 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 blah. But I still got to lay my head on my pillow at night. And even if you give me a little credit for any of that stuff, I still know you're giving it to somebody I'm making up. Fear. Oh my God, what if they find out? Oh my God, what if I never get this thing? Oh my God, what if I'm never successful? Oh my God, what happens when I get the success if I'm going to fail? Oh my God. And it goes on and on and on and on. I got to do something about it. I can't live in fear and stay sober. I can't live in fear and think that I'm not going to cave to that conflict on the inside to get relief. I have to do something about it. So I have to list them. So I list them, just like I did in the resentments. Then I ask myself, why am I afraid? Well, I was never responsible. I was never committed enough. I never consistent enough on a job. I got fired, you know. She slept on me, but I slept on her. I mean, you know, it just goes on. Why am I afraid? I'm afraid I'm going to lose something I have, or I'm not going to get something I want out of the relationship with whatever that fear is. And what instincts are impacted by that fear? Certainly my personal relationships are all impacted by fear, right? My self-esteem is without a doubt impacted by fear. My self-worth, my value of myself, I feel like such a scumbag when I get here and such a loser and a failure. My God. And I'm blaming everybody else for the result. Right? I'm afraid I'm going to lose her. I'm afraid I'm going to lose them. I'm afraid I'm not going to get them back. I'm afraid I'm not going to get her back. I'm afraid I'm going to go to jail and lose my freedom. I'm afraid I'm going to... It just goes on and on and on. But what part do I play in these fears? Why do I even have them? It's very simple. It's because of the way I was playing life. It was simply because of the way I was, you know, gaming everybody. Of course I got fears. But what was the driving source? What was the fuel that had me do what I did to become afraid of? Selfishness, self-centeredness, self-consumption. Self manifested in 1,000 different ways. Right? Inconsideration. Dishonesty. I was a habitual liar when I got here. What if they found out the truth? Oh my God. What if they find out I'm not a tough guy? Oh my God. Somebody might hurt me. I mean, we make most of it up. So we got it all down paper. And we looked at it. And then I addressed sexual harms. Things I did within my relationships with other women. Same thing women will do for men with this thing. right? So I could have her on resentment list. I could really be pissed off at her for what she did to me. But then as I process through the resentments and I see that I set it all up, oh my God, what? Now I fear her. And now I get the sexual harms in my, oh my God, what did I do to her? You get it? This works perfectly. Perfectly. If I don't acknowledge and find out and gain understanding of what's broken in my relationships to other people, because let's face it, that's what it's all about. My relationships to other people. And what drives me in those relationships, which is nothing but the instincts. You see, we have to get clear on what we're attempting to satisfy through other people. And once we get beyond this, we'll have to draw back into our instincts to make sure they're not out of whack with other people. So we can have balanced, intimate, authentic relationships. But I've got to acknowledge what's broken first. So I get into it. What did I do to her? Well, I stole time from her. I went and drank all the money and, you know, and squandered all the financial, you know, ability to pay the rent and pay the electric, and I was gone and had to go to jail and just abandon her and on and on and on. All the things that we do to people, right? And ladies, you got the same problems going on, right? It's how we do life. You're not mad at her because she cheated on me. Well, what did I do? Said, but well, I cheated on her. I mean, it just goes back and forth and back and forth. But this gives me an opportunity to really see a clear picture and the truth about the matter. Because I'm going to tell you something. This is all set up to become crystal clear about the exact nature of the wrongs. This isn't about establishing and just, you know, just coming to clearly see the harm. It's going into the hurt. What did I do to that person? I emotionally traumatized them. I violated their trust. I destroyed the relationships they may have had branching off just from mine. What about their families? What about the worry I created in them by the way I was treating their daughter? What about the children? Right? I got it all down. I got it all down. And they say this. You see, nothing really happens until we address this. The first three steps are just me coming to some conclusions. The first couple steps, just coming to some conclusions and making a decision. Either I'm an alcoholic and I suffer from the allergy and the obsession, or I'm not. Either I can't stop when I start or control it, and I can't stay stopped. If that fits for you, it's pretty simple, and it's obvious no human power could keep me stopped. They could get me stopped. They could help me get stopped. They couldn't keep me stopped. This is what started me again, right? And then I just simply make the decision to seek this power by the way they've got laid out. And the first thing they say to do immediately, at once, is an inventory. And so we've done that. But nothing really happens to my psyche or my emotional nature or the ability to go from who I became, which I just uncovered, to beginning that process of becoming who I can be without this work. And this is what they say is the first personality change, right? This is the first change in my personality because they say something really interesting happens. It says if we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot. Yeah. It says we've listed and analyzed our resentments. We've begun to, and notice this, when we get here, it's all about they're the problem. They're the problem. Now, it says, we've begun to comprehend the futility and the fatality of the resentments. Never had that before. I was a consummate victim when I got here. Now I'm starting to comprehend the futility and fatality of these resentments and know what they are. It says, I've commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. I'm starting to see what it's been doing to my life and doing to their lives. It says we've begun to learn tolerance. Well, man, I never had that. I always wanted mercy for me and I wanted judgment for you. That was me. That was just my come from, right? It says, I've begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men. I never had that. Huh? Even our enemies. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Everybody was my enemy. For we look on them as sick people. Well, I don't know about you guys. And I don't have a nice word for how I looked on them. But all of them were that. Yeah, I won't repeat it, but we all have one, okay? It says, we've listed the people that we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. So I have this new desire, this new want in my life. I want to live. I want to live without that in my life. I want to get rid of this conflict. For me to want that's crazy. I always used to drink and drug at that. I never desired to be rid of it. I didn't even know it was possible. Do you see what's happening here? Now, it says in this book, you read again and again, that faith did for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. So we've begun with this belief. We became willing to believe based on the fact that we were dying when we got here. Couldn't stop drinking, right? All our relationships were in the toilet. And they say the cornerstone is simply believing or coming to believe that this power greater than us can restore us to sanity. We don't have faith yet. We have faith in us. That's who we have faith in. We have faith in the way I navigate life. Even though I couldn't see the truth about the destruction I was causing by that faith in me, right? So they say just have this belief. And do some certain simple things, take some certain simple steps, fulfill some requirements, and you can have it too. And I had to trust my sponsor with this. I didn't feel it at that moment. I didn't have faith that God could do for me what I couldn't do for myself. I wasn't really, I believed John. So now I'm doing this work, trusting that there is a better outcome for my life. And I'm starting to have these personality change, these paradigm shifts in my way of thinking. I'm starting to look at people like, I'm starting to look at the guy in the mirror as the problem and the source of all this destruction. And not until I'm able to do that, am I able to have even a sense that it can be corrected. You see, if I identify it, I can correct it. I can stop doing what doesn't work and begin to do what does with coaching and people surrounding me that are going to support me on that vision and on that quest, right? So the faith comes through additional work. So it says, we hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him, because it's beginning to happen. I'm having this shift in the way I view my life, right? I'm starting to feel a sense of accomplishment in the betterment of my own life by doing this, right? It says, if you have already made a decision, step 3, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, step 4, you've made a good, doesn't say you hit the finish line. It says you made a good beginning. So we've just begun. But now we're going to take this journey into this realm of humility, this right sizing, this acknowledgement of my brokenness to another human being in the presence of God, right? It says, that being so, you've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. It says in the next chapter, which is 6, it says into action. Many of us go into that into thinking mode and nothing happens, right? I have to get this out of me. I have to be liberated from this garbage that I have been harboring all my life. Right? I have to get it out into the light. It says, having made our personal inventory, what should we do about it? Here's what we've been doing since day 1. We've been trying to get a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator. We did our inventory. We completed our inventory. Right? Take comfort in that. Be inspired by that. We've done something to get us from point A to point B. We've gotten a step closer to the spiritual awakening that they promise. Many of us die before ever getting there. Many of us die knowing that we have to do that and never doing it. So take comfort in that. Take confidence in that, right? Be inspired by that. Because that in of itself was an act and a display to God with this decision we make to turn our will and our lives over to His care. That was a display to Him that we really mean it. That's the evidence that we mean it. The action that validated our decision to seek Him. Right? It says, we've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator. That's the evidence, right? We're not done. And discover the obstacles in our path. We've looked at this, right? We've admitted certain defects and we've ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. From secrets to exposure, right? This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature, that we go back to that exact nature of the wrong. We're going to look at it. We're going to look at why we did it. We're going to look at our motives. Right? We're going to focus on what drove me, what made my decisions be what they were. And we're going to look at the damage. We're going to look at the harm, the actual act, and we're going to look at the hurt behind it. We're going to step into their shoes. If anybody did what we did to other people, we'd probably shoot them. They stole what we stole from them. Time, emotional peace, comfort, trust, reliability, all those things, right? So we do this. And believe me, back when they wrote this, the sponsorship really wasn't as prevalent as it is today. I mean, this is if we're going to expose our deepest secrets and things about us to another human being, it would be a huge advantage to do it with your sponsor. The person that's actually going to coach you from who you have become into who you can be. This profound alteration in your reaction to life, this transformation, caterpillar to the butterfly. See, we're in a cocoon right now. We're going through the work. We're trying to get out. It's not comfortable, but you know what? We know it's necessary. But we want to emerge a free person. We want to emerge that caterpillar, that butterfly. Right? We've all had wings. We've all been able to fly. We haven't been able to do it because we've been stuck. Right? So it says, there's in the 12 and 12, there's a definition of humility, and most of us know it in here. It's called a clear recognition of who and what we really are, followed by a sincere attempt to become who we can be. See, we weren't born to be who we've become. We were born to be far greater. We were born to be a created masterpiece of a loving God that adores us. But we've covered it up. We've chased other things, right? We've chased what we thought would make us happy, make us satisfied and complete. But we've been actually fabricating ourselves destiny it's like this self-manifested destiny. Well, I don't know about you guys when you got here, but I didn't sure like me at all. I hated myself. I hated my guts. I hated my life. I hated everything in it. I hated everything about it. And I didn't think it was even close to being possible that I could think, feel, see, interpret, perceive any other way. I thought I was life sentenced to feeling the way I felt. Greatest lie of all. Right? I bought into my smallness. I bought into my limitations, self-imposed limitations. I bought into that thing, that person. You know? We're all meant to shine. We're all meant to shine, and we're all meant to be individuals. Right? We're all meant to be fully self-expressed without worrying what you think of me. I have allowed other people to keep me in bondage to my smallness. By my, not your fault, mine. Right? So this humility, this ability to find out who I've become in step four, and the sincere attempt to become who I can be begins with 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Right? That's the attempt to become who I can be. My best possibility rather than my worst. Right? Says, having persevered with the rest of the... He says, we wonder why they fell. It says, we think the reason that they never completed house cleaning. We found out what was in the house, but we never cleaned the house, right? It says, we think the reason is they took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. Anybody ever tells you they're humble? They're full of doo-doo. They're trying to sell you something, right? Humility is an expression. Humility is a essence of a human being. It's the perfect essence of humility in another human being is knowing who they are and whose they are. Right? Knowing where God is and where we are. Right? It says, but they have not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense that we find it necessary until they told someone else all their life story. This is the deep dive. This is where we expose it. The four-step inventory is an inventory. It's a tickler sheet. It's a category of things that we're going to embellish on and discuss deeply with our sponsor, right? And I guess some people got it wrong when, I know that there's probably therapeutic value in writing my life story, but I can tell you right now, I'm going to come out on top in my life story. I don't know about you guys. Everybody else is still going to be who they are, right? So I'm sure that there's some therapeutic value. I mean, I've done them in treatment. I've written life stories and this and that and the other. But when I came out to the end on the last chapter, y'all were still wrong, right? So it says in step 5, we tell someone all our life story, right? The book says the inventory, then the divulging of that, the confession. So it says we must be entirely ready with somebody if we expect to live long and happily in this world. Well, why in God's name would I even be in this deal if I wasn't attempting to live happily and usefully in this world? If you'd have told me that I would have had to feel the way I felt when I got here, but I had to stop drinking and continue to feel that madness and that conflict on the inside, that really nothing would change there, I'd say, you're out of your frickin' mind. Give me a bottle or a gun. I'm not dumb. I'm going to take care of this deal. Right? I didn't come to AA to feel miserable. But yet there are many in AA that live in darkness and are miserable because they haven't looked at the truth of who they are. Hopefully, they will be able to do so before they die. But this is all about freedom. This is about something completely different than what a lot of people in AA discuss. Don't get me wrong. We're in the greatest fellowship on earth. The most altruistic movement on earth. Right? But what do we stand for? Do we stand for people to reach their best potential? Or to feel like losers all their life? Right? There's two fellowships in AA. There's two fellowships. The one they're talking about here is the fellowship of the Spirit, the fellowship of freedom and outrageousness and authenticity and accomplishment, possibilities. And then there's the wisdom of the rooms. Just don't drink, go to meetings. Hang in there. Most of them walking around looking like they've been hit in the face with a dead fish. I don't want to hang out with those people. I love them, and I'll tolerate them. But I see them coming from the back of the room, I'm like walking that way. You know why? Because victims will seek out other victims, and it's like that conspiracy theory. I'll buy your doo-doo if you buy mine. So I'm going to listen to your doo-doo, but you're damn sure going to listen to mine. That's how it works. That's not what I want to talk about. Right? So it says, so we pocket our pride. We go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. And once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, listen to this. Listen to this based on how we felt 24 hours before we got to Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter where you were, right? We are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. I couldn't even look at my own self in the mirror in my eyes. It was so filthy in there. It says we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Are you kidding me? Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We've emerged into the beginning of a spiritual awakening. Our spirits are beginning to awake. This sixth sense that we were choked off from, never felt, is now beginning to be unchoked. We're starting to sense the power, right? It says we may have had certain spiritual beliefs. I think all of us do at some point. But now we begin to have this spiritual experience. We start to have the development of relationship. Right? Relationship. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. It may not come strongly. But what will begin to happen is when you face adversity or things that in life that are upsetting and disrupting, your mind won't go to what it did for you. It'll begin to seep in of what it, I'm sorry, what it did to you. Did I say that right? What'll happen is, let me start over. Your mind won't go to what it did for you. It'll go to what it did to you. And boom, you start to recoil. And if you have that crazy thought because you haven't gotten all the way to the other side yet, when you start to have that feeling of what it did for you, you call somebody right away and you tell on yourself. Right? Because there's much bigger things that lie ahead. It says, we feel that we're on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Wow. That's amazing. Everybody that comes to AA should be able to desire to have that. This is our message. This is the message. There's nothing about the mess in here. This is what we carry. But we're only halfway through, right? We're only like halfway through this deal. And then it says we get our first timeline, right? We get our first break. It says we return home for an hour. Not a year. Not 6 months. Not 3 weeks. For an hour, right? And we reflect on what we did. Have we really done the best we could with what we've gone through so far? And then next week we'll talk about 6 and 7. Thanks.
If we could thank the speaker one more time. And now we'll have Heather up for the secretary report.
Hi, my name is Heather, and I'm your recovered alcoholic secretary. In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. I have asked Katie to come up and read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, everyone. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Katie. Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime, but we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in the body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
Thank you, Katie. In 1940s-style big book sponsorship from Forward to the Second Edition, Alcoholics Anonymous, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experienced is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I have a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? Is there anyone in need of a sponsor? All right. Guess everyone is recovered. So it's Thursday, and we have some announcements. We have the Broward County Intergroup. If you've never been there, you should definitely go to the new store and check it out. It's got a lot of really interesting books, a couple different languages of the big book. They also have a website that you can go to and find like a million volunteer opportunities. So if you need to do service or you have a sponsee that needs to do service, you can go on the website and find it here, or you can get a flyer or just simply go to the office. We have the Fellowship of the Spirit coming up. It's going to be right here. We're flying in Mickey and Marie from Denver, Colorado, June 22nd and 23rd. So you can see Mike Chase in the back of the room for tickets, or you can just log online and you can purchase them there. It's going to be AA and Al-Anon. Ooh, what's this? We have the Pathway to Power with Chris Raymer. He's amazing, super intense, but really great. He's going to be June 27th, in Jensen Beach, Florida. We have the state convention that is going to be in August. It takes an army to put one of these things together, so if you have not signed up for a service commitment, you can do that. You can also go online and get signed up for this. And then we have the Women in Recovery. It's also AA and Al-Anon, but it's only for women. Sorry, guys. It's going to be in August. And then the Jersey Shore Roundup, November 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. And that's pretty much it. Monday nights, we have our Big Book study meeting here where the Big Book comes alive. Fellowship is at 6:30. The Big Book starts at 7:15. We have CDs, mugs, large print big books, little red book, and big book dictionaries for sale. And we meet here every Thursday starting promptly at 7:15. We ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. See you all next week.
We have tonight's session and all past speaker podcasts online for free at alcoholicsandgod.org. I'd like to invite everyone to our Monday night big book study. Those who wish to thank the speaker, please line up down the center aisle, and let's close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, see you on Monday or next Thursday, God's will. Just a reminder, there's no smoking, 75 feet in front of the door, please.
little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine.